Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of The Group Chat. I am news correspondent at Virgin Media News, Richard Chambers. I'm joined, as ever, by fellow news correspondent Zara King.
Hello.
And political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Hello there.
Guys, we're starting with news. Huge developments in the crime world over the course of the week. Jonathan Dowdle looks set to be given a new identity and relocated to another country after he agreed to provide evidence relating to the 2016 Regency Hotel shooting in the trial of Jerry Hutz. The threat against him for turning state witnesses currently described as severe, and he's been taken into protective custody along with members of his family. He will be assessed for inclusion in the state's witness security program. Now, for more on what witness security is, how it operates, and the history behind it, we are joined by author and journalist Nicola Tallant of The Sunday World, also the brains behind The Witness podcast and The Crime World podcast.
Which maybe gives me a little bit of an edge on the witness protection.
This is your forte, Nicola.
Listen to the witness in his own words. Like, do that after you listen to this, because it is honestly, like, I mean that, it's truly excellent work.
Recently winner of podcast awards,
yeah.
If I'm not mistaken,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. That was a bit of a work of passion now, I have to say, the witness, and, you know, bringing that story first to a book and then to a podcast.
Yeah.
It's so rare that you get somebody out of that world who's so articulate, so able to tell their own story, own it and understand it. And that's what Joey O'Callaghan was and is. And in a way, when I said it gives me a bit of an edge, like, I have spoken to a few people who've been in witness protection, but particularly Joey's story, I think, is, you know, shows the starkness of it.
Mm.
It's a really weird thing.
Well, what's the history behind it there? Well, for people who don't know, how many people would have gone through this? Where did it all get started, really, in this country?
In this country, yeah. It started when Veronica Guerin was murdered. Mm. And prior to that, it had started in the US and in Italy to try and take down the mafias, because they needed to, basically, anybody who was going to give evidence against them was going to get shot dead. So they needed to keep them alive to put them in the witness box so they could give their evidence. And actually, that is really what it is about here as well. So it started then, and Charlie Bowden and Russell Warren were the first two people into it. For those who don't remember, they were part of John Gilligan's gang, and they gave evidence in the special criminal court against members of the gang and who were charged with various different things in relation to her murder. Now, their evidence didn't go down very well in that court. Charlie Bowden in particular, it was, you know, the judges believed that he would have been willing to say anything to get himself off the hook. And this is the problem with it. And in a way, this is where Jonathan Dowdall is sitting, because on Monday, I was in the courts and we, first of all, heard the evidence during the sentence hearing, because he has pleaded guilty to a lesser charge than murder. So we heard that he was going into this program and what a sacrifice this was going to be to him. And his family had to go in as well, the threat he was going to be under. And, you know, then we go along to the Monks trial and it's adjourned because of this. Mm. So Jonathan Dowdall, the fact is that the murder charge against him was dropped by the state.
Yeah.
Hours after we heard that he was going into witness protection.
Is that what it effectively amounts to, that it's effectively plea bargaining, that you agree to turn witness in exchange for a lesser charge and you accept that and then
sometimes
go away?
Mm. So sometimes they will appear to do this bargaining behind the scenes with the director of public prosecutions. The witnesses that are preferred are the ones without anything to gain, who have come along, the likes of Joey O'Callaghan, who believes that something, you know, that a life shouldn't be taken by another human being and they want to do the right thing. So they are obviously clearly the better, are seen certainly as a cleaner witness maybe. Dowdall, that murder charge has been dropped. He's currently, his legal teams are looking for a suspended sentence for him in relation to this lesser charge that he's pleaded guilty to. and he has convictions. And we heard the details of those convictions in during the sentence hearing. Quite a serious conviction for kidnap, and he kidnapped this guy who was trying to buy his motorbike.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Very strange. I never got my head around that.
Yeah.
Somebody was trying to buy a motorbike off him, like from Tundeel or something, and
they
were negotiating.
Did he invite him for dinner or something?
He invited him for dinner.
Right.
Has that ever happened to you?
No. No, right. On Tundeel, but maybe.
And I've never invited someone to dinner in my house if I'm trying to sell anything.
Might be Tundeel by that. Might be the buy and sell. Could be anything. Yeah, yeah, just to be clear.
But
yeah.
This happened. This man was invited along to his house for dinner. He was brought into the garage where Dowdall and his father, who's 63, basically tortured him, waterboarded him, threatened to take his fingers off of the pliers and kill him, told him they were members of the IRA. And yeah, so that's a pretty serious conviction they both have, and they both served lengthy sentences for that. So that will be there as well. You know,
and so like when you say like, you know, he's pleaded guilty to the lesser charge, is it a guarantee then that he won't have to serve prison time, or would he have to serve prison time before being put into witness protection, or what are the logistics?
Well, that's
that?
Exactly what happened on Monday morning during that right. sentence hearing. His senior counsel, Michael O'Higgins, was asking the court to consider giving him a suspended sentence because it's very messy trying to go into witness protection if one person is in prison and then the rest of the family, because we were told his wife and his four children aged between 11 and 25 are also going into this witness protection, along with his father, who has multiple health complications, as has Dowdall himself. So basically the legal team were asking the courts, give him a suspended sentence and, you know,
effectively allow him to assume a new identity immediately.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't happen immediately. What happens is, under witness protection, the witness is kept alive to get into the witness box.
Yes.
They give their evidence. And once they've done that, they're signed off the programme. They're helped relocate to a new country, usually English speaking. They're given new identities, social security numbers, whatever they need. And they will essentially, the likes of, say, Dowdall has a house, they'd sell that, the state would sell it, and he would be helped to get an equivalent property wherever he goes.
Okay, so the country that they're relocated to, so you mentioned that they're English speaking, it'll be on the same sort of par. Like, I mean, you'd use the money for the house that he's sold, it would be the same value then in England or Australia or wherever else he ends up going to.
And if somebody was without assets or, you know, on social welfare, they're moved and they're put on social welfare in that country. They're helped into that system.
Gotcha.
And is that because they don't want to be seen to be paying witnesses or for them to benefit from giving evidence?
They can't be seen. The state can't be seen as doing that, you know, as buying evidence as such. So, yeah. But, you know, things happen behind the scenes. And
but are you right? Getting onto witness protection isn't a guarantee, is it, Nicola? Like, I mean, there is a rigorous process, and even like the psychological assessment around it and everything, not everyone's cut out for witness protection.
No. Now, in Ireland, we know very little really about what happens. And certainly Joey O'Callaghan, who I do know a lot about, would be very critical of how he went onto the programme. He was very young. He believes it wasn't explained to him properly, really, what was, you know, his future was. And he says he got no legal advice, independent legal advice.
What age was he again at the start?
He was 19.
Yeah.
God, it's a huge change for that age of your life.
Well, I mean, it was, he went into it on his own. Mm. And when he was relocated, he was on his own. I don't think he'd ever paid a bill on his own or anything. And he was literally sort of, he feels, thrown into the total unknown with a lot of trauma as well.
And what was really sad for him was that he had a great like love and affection for his mum, didn't he, and his sister and stuff, and he was very close to them, and like trying to cope without them after everything.
He was supposed to never speak to them again. I mean, that's what that program is about.
Is that one of the conditions of it, that like not only do you don't get to basically adopt a new skin, you completely cut all ties, you don't even drop a social phone call at Christmas to say how you're doing, you're totally...
Is that high risk, I guess?
That's what it's supposed to be, you know what I mean? Right. But like, human beings don't always follow rules.
Well, especially when you talk about someone's kids going into the program, like, how do you explain to children? Okay, maybe the ones in their 20s will get the significance of it, but like, how do you explain to kids kind of 11 and onwards, you know, your life is being uprooted and being totally changed? It's a big adjustment.
Huge.
To put a whole family in like that.
And they have to lie.
Yeah.
Going forward, they're given a, you know, a new backstory that they have to learn sort of off. And
how does that come, they come up with that? So does it offer, like, I know that there's nothing, you mentioned that it's very hard to understand how any of this works because nothing's ever, like, there's nothing official down there. You don't look at a statute book or whatever.
Yeah.
So how do they come up with the stories and the backstories then for
Well, see, it is a very secretive programme, and, you know, there's no accountability here in this country because it's not wrapped in any legislation.
Yeah.
It just operates. And anytime you ask any questions about it, you're stonewalled completely. So I don't really know. Mm-hmm. I only know from the people I have spoken to, many of whom have reached out from various places to, you know, to give a little bit of, to have a little bit of a chat or whatever. But the backstories are made up by cops working on the programme, and they're given to, they're not really very, certainly the ones I've heard, they wouldn't really be that clever.
Sophisticated?
No.
Mm.
No.
But it's a fairly routine, black and white. You're from this area, you've moved for work. And it's as basic as that.
And like, crucially, Nicola, the people who want to maybe, you know, get to the people who are in witness protection, do they generally try very hard to track down these people? Or does it, I mean, it obviously depends case by case, but would there generally be a witch hunt for these people? Or, you know, could they maybe go about their lives for 10 years and then all of a sudden when they least expect it, you know, someone could track them down?
To my knowledge, nobody has.
Or do people kind of generally move on and forget about it? Or
nobody has actually been killed.
Within the programme.
That is either on the programme, there have been threats to life while they're on the programme, and when they're off it, you don't really, they kind of become ghosts, so you don't really know. It's very difficult to say what happens to them, yeah, or if anybody comes after them, because they don't communicate or contact, and their old identities are dead and gone. And they aren't, I mean, part of the rules of the programme appear to be that you never come back here looking for help again. Like, once you have got your help once, that's it.
Mm.
And if you come back, you're not going to get protection or...
To what degree are the countries that they go to aware of these new people being parachuted into them, or do they have much of a collaboration in helping to sort them out with passports or birth certs under their new identities or all the paperwork that they need?
Yeah, like they do help. Like we would work ourselves with other countries, and we probably have people here that are, you know, coming from somewhere else and maybe in witness protection or have been in witness protection and are here relocated under new identities. We send ours to places and they'll send theirs to here. So yeah, they all work together, but the world has just become a little bit, like, since it was set up, you know, people travel more for a start.
Mm.
Obviously there's the social media thing. I mean, you can't go new identity. You can't really change your face.
Mm.
It's pretty hard. And then if you have an entire family and you have to change all their faces, like a lot of surgery.
But it must make it then very curious, just on a practical level, that if you do show up in another country and hypothetically you're in circumstances like Jonathan Dowdle's, where you're moving with a partner and four children and a father, and seven of you show up in a brand new jurisdiction and you're trying to pass yourself off as being this three-dimensional person that has a history and a life story, and there is nothing online at all to give any backup to that. You've got no fleshed out LinkedIn with job endorsements.
No Facebook or whatever.
Facebook, no Twitter, no Instagrams.
Mm. Unless you start like a fake Facebook and you build it up over a couple of weeks or something. I don't know.
It must make it much more difficult then to do it in the 2022 era where people expect to have an online background.
It absolutely has to. Like, I mean, isn't that the biggest red flag when you can't find anything?
Absolutely.
Oh my God.
If somebody you
no
found
digital
anywhere.
Footprint is an absolute red flag.
I mean, it's total walk away from this person.
No way.
Anyway. So,
no second date there.
Yeah, I mean, that's curious. I actually don't know if they're sophisticated enough that they are building those backstories for them. Possibly they are. Possibly they are.
It would make sense to
But you can't put their pictures up on the internet.
Yeah,
no matter
facial
what
recognition these days is something which even search engines do, looking around.
And even when you think about like CCTV cameras, and like we're all caught on camera probably like a dozen times a day, and we don't even realize it. Do you know what
I mean? Sure, if you go out anywhere, I mean, I don't really like getting photographed when I'm out and about and stuff, but like you do have to dodge it because everybody's got their phone out and everybody wants to show the world where they are at a particular point in time. So I mean. You'd be a weirdo, wouldn't you? You'd be very strange. You'd have a very strange paranoia you'd be living with if you were on the programme and you couldn't be photographed. You had no digital footprint. Maybe your story has a few holes and it's hard to lie all the time.
It is.
I mean, it's
like
strange.
Your whole podcast, so just for anyone, if you haven't listened to it, I mean, I can't stress enough how much you have to listen to it. But like, I suppose, as you said, Nicola, like the thing that was so... like magnificent about the podcast, to be totally honest with you, was the fact that you really felt like you were hearing a side of the story that you'd never heard before. Like all of us have covered, we're not crime correspondents, we've covered court cases, we've covered murders, and you never ever get to hear that firsthand account from a young person who started out in a milk round and was groomed into this kind of life of crime and like the ramifications of it and the fact that it completely changed Joey's life. Like, how is he coping now? Sort of like, you know, after the tapes finish rolling and you're kind of, you guys are essentially kind of friends, really. You've been, you've worked together, colleagues and friends through all of this. He remains in witness protection or is kind of off the program or whatever, but
he's off the
program.
He has liaison officers and he has, he's very much learned how to realize. And I think it's a good lesson for anybody that you are really your first and last port of call when it comes to security.
Yeah.
And like, you can't really rely on anybody else. You have to rely on yourself. Be aware, you know, look, he probably sits with his back to the wall. He probably doesn't go places that he might be recognized in. He probably has a restricted enough social life. You know, the threats to people like Joey O'Callaghan who've given evidence against people are real threats. They're not perceived. They are real. And yet they can't overdo the paranoia about it. So they have to live day to day and for the rest of their lives with this real threat. So, you know, going around the house, locking the doors, making sure they're locked a second time, cameras, security alarms, you know, that is actually necessary. But then you have to learn to also live with it. I often thought that, you know, we've probably forgotten now and we don't like talking about it, but at the beginning of COVID, when everybody realised that this threat was very real, it was out there and you had to change what you did. It's a little bit like that. And then that those changes become normalised and you do them as a matter of,
as a routine. How many Joeys are there out there? How many people have been into the programme? How many people are living in other parts of the world? There isn't even like an official record of that.
All I think that they seem to give out is an idea of what the spend is from the programme.
Right.
But there's no detail on that. So is that spend, you know...
Is it 1.2 million a year?
Something? Well, that's...
Is that the budget that's assigned for it, but they never spend the whole lot?
You'd wonder what bit of it that's assigned for or if that is... You know, that I keep reading that they haven't spent and all of a sudden the last year they spent 1.2. That's very little.
1.2 million is...
But if it is all one-off costs, if it is just sorting someone out with paperwork and a house and then it's one-off and you're not meeting their upkeep afterwards, then maybe actually it's quite a lot to, you know, set up new identities for...
I do know that certainly in the past people have been, you know, they have been given money by the state. They have, like. So I don't know. Again, it's very secretive and there's no accountability whatsoever. We've no rights to ask any questions about it. And if we do, we're stonewalled.
What would the benefit of that be? Like, what would, do you think that's the way it should be moved into to try and, you know, make sure that it's a process that isn't open to abuse or whatever?
I think that, that is very important that it isn't open to abuse. And that's really why some questions should be answered, obviously, without putting people at risk. I mean, I don't think they should be answering questions like, where do people relocate? Or, you know,
can't be putting forward maps on these things. Like,
pinpoint them. Or, you know, it's obvious the kind of questions they shouldn't answer. But there are some questions that should be answered, I think, and to safeguard people, because they really do go into it and they disappear, like, in every way, and we've no idea. I think what I learned from Joey's story was that I feel that there should be some aftercare. I think there should be a little bit of aftercare, and I think people should be given, they obviously don't want everybody coming back going, I didn't like it.
I'm done with that.
You can't have that situation. But I think that they also have to realise that everybody who goes into it is an individual with individual needs. And
well, Joey had a lot of trauma. Like, he had an awful lot of trauma when he went into the programme. I mean, and even like trying to trust therapists probably and knowing who he could really open up to was probably quite difficult. I mean, how do you, you know, go into witness protection and then also sort of, you know, maybe go to a therapist and start dealing with, you know, the sexual abuse trauma and all of those things that he would have gone through? Because, you know, how can you tell that story when you're not meant to be that person anymore? Like, a lot of that is, you know, kind of
all of that
big
is the problem, like, you know. But he eventually actually was, he did a year in the Priory and was healed as much as possible. And he lives now with the mental illnesses that he has. You know, they've certainly identified some of the traumas he suffered while with Brian Kenny were the cause of them. But, you know, he has, they're medicated, some of them, and then, you know, he continues with his therapy and stuff. But it took a big battle to get that, you know, that priory time. And it has saved his life, and it has made living with this constant threat more viable for him.
Yeah. So really, I suppose in summary, it isn't really like you're sailing off into the sunset in this situation when you are put into this programme.
Certainly, I don't think that is the case at all. Now, maybe some of them, maybe the ones who haven't phoned me are having a ball, I don't know. But certainly anyone I've spoken to, and there's been a few, are not in good places. Like,
okay,
it's not easy.
Right. Well, Nicola, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about it. Really fascinating conversation. And yeah, thanks so much for joining us in the group chat.
So much. Yeah, thanks, Nicola.
Nice to be here.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Right, Nicola Tallant.
Oh, she's
fascinating world.
It's so fascinating. Like, I'm so piqued by the idea that there is just this kind of legal void where you just mint up all the paperwork and identity for someone and just buy them a one-way ticket to somewhere and go, right, that's it, you're on your own. And actually the fact that they are on their own, when a lot of them have been through, even the idea of maybe like testifying in sensitive cases could be like traumatic enough, but even having been through the prospect of being involved or groomed into a world of crime, the idea that you're just packed off and
well,
there's
Joey
no
O'Callaghan was very much on his own, but I suppose in this instance, this will be like an entire family going into witness protection, which is a little bit different. I mean, it's hard to know whether it is it more of a comfort to have the people you love around you, or is it going to be far more heartbreaking because they're also going through this with
makes
you.
It more difficult as well.
I'd imagine it does make it much more difficult because
when you have multiple people who are all having to go through the same, effectively the same charade and try and keep everything watertight.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting, I suppose, how the difficulties of a change because of social media and 4K and 8K cameras and face recognition. You see, even this thing, I was only just thinking about it when Nicola
Glasses
was talking.
And cameras in them.
No, there was this thing, some lad made this AI robot which matched stuff from Instagram influencers, what they posted when they posted photos, and he cross-referenced it with like public cameras and CCTV to sort of find when that photo was taken. Oh, and like there was an example taken of this influencer who posed for a photograph in Temple Bar, and they were able to cross-reference CCTV, the live cam there, and basically find that from a crowd in Temple Bar, this one guy doing the pose for the photograph on Instagram. And it's just the ability that you can do that actually sparked a bit of a conversation. It's like, here, nobody's ever really in private anymore.
Do you remember the controversy a few years back, though? And that, granted, this was in slightly different circumstances because I think they limited it to people who were marked as being your friends on Facebook. But there was that phase where Facebook would auto-tag people because they thought they were being helpful by recognizing people in photographs that you posted up and being like, oh, that's Zara King who's gone untagged at Gavin Riley's photograph there.
But even your phone does that. It'll say, like, oh, view more photos of mom or whatever, you know, and it'll show you because facial recognition.
Your iCloud or your Google Photos will do that for you.
Yeah, no, someone sent me a link yesterday to an article from Silicon Republic actually just about Meta smart glasses. Had you heard of these?
No,
these are
the ones they've been advertising in newspapers about how smart cameras will work inside glasses and that there'll be a little light
so
in the
corner. Saying Ray-Ban Stories glasses record footage. So basically, you can like, you know, I think they're voice activation. You can ask them to go into record. So they look like regular sunglasses. They look like regular sunglasses, but they have like little cameras.
Bit James Bond Jr.
It's a bit Black
Mirror. Really invasive.
Being able to like rewind back.
Recorded.
Well, I think the point is that the light is supposed to be on. This is why you've actually seen some newspaper ads recently from Meta showing you how smart glasses are going to work, because they've actually been mandated by some regulators to take out full page ads in papers to go, in case you're wondering what it is that you're seeing, if somebody has smart glasses, the camera isn't working unless there is a small pinprick light on. So it's to assure you what it means.
Some
on a really bright day, you might see that light. Like, I still would not be okay with somebody like filming me on their glasses. Like,
yeah.
One thing about it that Nicola was talking about is the lack of any sort of paper trail on this, the lack of any real accountability on this, because it isn't something that's underpinned by legislation.
Mm.
It's effectively run off the books by the guards. And I suppose that's really interesting as well, because she raises those questions of accountability and sort of what money is spent on it.
Yeah, and even the question mark about whether some of the money is just for informants in that sense, or whether it is to try and help them find a new identity. There is often said every year that there's always the humorous thing in the Public Accounts Committee in Leinster House, where they're going through the state accounts for the year and they come across the Secret Service. And the joke is, oh, we could tell you what it is, but then we'd have to kill you. But it's widely understood that what is defined as the Secret Service budget for the Irish government, because Ireland does not have a Secret Service, or at least if it's so secret, even those who run foreign intelligence.
That's what they want you to think.
Like Fight Club,
they don't know that it's there. Seemingly, the Secret Service is widely understood to be a budget for informants to allow them to be some. There is some pot of money that has to be given some label, which exists just to reward people for any intelligence that they bring forward, and maybe that is in its own way part of the process by which all of this is funded. But it is in a really mysterious legal cloud, isn't it?
It is, really. Yeah. I think the work that Nicola does is so important, though, isn't it? Like, I mean, we talk about journalism a lot on this podcast, but just, you know, the fact that she has that direct link to so many people like Joey O'Callaghan, and that she's able to offer people that insight. I mean, it's just something that, like, we've never seen before. And, like, we hear so many stories about, you know, what goes through the courts and the public side of crime, but actually, when you really see what people, you know, like Joey O'Callaghan...
Which is the reverse of it, Jeff.
Yeah. The reverse of it. Like, I remember we talked about it at the time when it first came out, her podcast, and like thinking that we just had never heard that account of it, like that, you know, we'd never heard the story of that young person that was groomed into that life of crime and the journey through into witness protection. So the work she does is just so important. Gab, I was going to ask you just in relation to the political ramifications of this story this week, because you know, clearly, you know, Jonathan Dowdle, former Sinn Féin councillor now. I mean, is there a political knock-on for the party on this? Or what have they been saying about it?
There are on two fronts. Firstly, because although their view has evolved in some recent years, Sinn Féin's stance on the very existence of the Special Criminal Court has always been something which is politically thorny. Sinn Féin historically have opposed the idea of there being non-jury courts like this. In the past, it was because most people being tried before these courts were Republican paramilitaries, and Sinn Féin had sympathy for their cause, and so therefore didn't agree with the idea that they were tried without a jury of their peers. So Sinn Féin's stance on the Special Criminal Court, which has evolved a little bit, they now abstain every year when the vote comes up in the Dáil on whether to renew it, is now coming under renewed focus. One thing which is slightly thornier in this instance is something of an open question as to exactly what Sinn Féin were aware of at the time that Jonathan Dowdall resigned his seat on the City Council and therefore his membership from the party as well. Because in other instances where people have left Sinn Féin and they have alleged bullying, as Jonathan Dowdall did at the time, Sinn Féin have been somewhat, well, you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out. Sometimes they can be very distant. They can say this was effectively a toxic relationship and we want to hear no more of it.
Mm.
The statement that they published at the time of Jonathan Dowdall's resignation could not have been more flowing and effuse and positive and grateful for the time that he had put in and lamenting the fact that he was no longer going to be a part of their family. And I think it is only in hindsight now that we know exactly the degree to which Jonathan Dowdall was engaged in really unsavoury stuff at the time that questions are being asked in not too explicit a way because of the sensitivities of there being an ongoing court case around it. But there are certainly some live political questions for Sinn Féin to answer about the degree to which they were aware that not everything about Jonathan Dowdall was what it seemed.
It's that question, Richard, about that awareness. Like, what is a reasonable expectation of a political party in terms of background checks on their members and their representatives? And like, what, you know, what do we consider to be, you know, should we know everything about all these public representatives, or, you know, how much can you know, really?
Like, I think it's very, very hard to know
it's
what you can
answer,
know, because you can't expect to be able to go through for something as reasonably low level as the membership of a local authority. Like, there are 1,000 county and city councillors across the country. So what is a fair degree of prior scrutiny?
How
much,
like,
how much
do you know,
previous do you need to go into for something as at the bottom level of the chain of government, if you get me?
Mm. On the other side of politics over the last week then, Gavin, the Ardèche was on for Fianna Fáil
last
weekend. We've talked a lot about how the fact that Fianna Fáil seem to be looking for their identity.
Did they find it that weekend?
If there was an identity to be found, it was more about not necessarily what they are or who, what they stand for so much as who they aren't and who they oppose. There was a quip made in the press room that Fianna Fáil's solution to the housing crisis is to allow Sinn Féin live rent-free in their heads, because there was some amount of mentions of Sinn Féin, both on the stage throughout the Friday evening and Saturday afternoon, where the panellists and ministers were consistently talking about things the government is doing. Oh, and by the way, Sinn Féin are full of empty rhetoric and broken promises.
Feels very Fine Gael to me.
There's a little bit of that, but it was more about the...
That's how all Ardeshes work, though. Like, all Ardeshes, they do all descend, and that's where all the biggest cheers will come from. That's where the biggest energy shift will come from, because you're identifying... Here's the opponent.
Here's our reason for doing what we're doing. And that was certainly the case as well for Norma Foley's speech. She spoke before the Taoiseach, and obviously her speech is directed at the people in the room, whereas the Taoiseach is speaking not only to the hall, but also to people watching it at home on TV. Mm. The biggest cheers that Norma Foley got were certainly for the rounds of Shinner bashing, as they might see it. But you're right to a point, Richard, that of course it is always about that when you're trying to, you know, rile up your party faithful, that you talk about your common enemies and the like. But given how much Fianna Fáil is trying to talk about the work that it's doing in government and all these massive crises that it's trying to tackle and which it insists it is making good progress on, ostensibly they should have more positive things to talk about than to be consistently talking about this other party that they profess is only trying to be like a fly swatting them around the face.
Then if that is the case and all they are able to talk about in many ways is Sinn Féin plus some of their track record of last 2 years, I'd say that they don't have much of an identity found yet. Well, they're still scrambling down the back of that sofa for the 2 euro coin that is their identity.
This is it. They did adopt a revised version of their party constitution, which has 12 aims and objectives, and apparently that is only the third time in 90 years of Fianna Fáil history that they've done that. So that was an attempt to figure out what it is that they stand for, but a lot of people would look at those 12 objectives, like, you know, fair employment and good education, and they would find it to be common with a lot of other parties.
And there wasn't much of a bounce for the 11 billion cost of living budget for Fianna Fáil. Like, it didn't seem like they got the credit maybe for that in the...
Well, this was the other thing. There were two other telling things about that weekend at the RDS when the Ardesh was on. Firstly, that I have been at Ardesh and party conferences before where a poll noticeably changes the mood almost within minutes of it getting out. I've been at Ardesh where a party is going into a leader speech and suddenly they find out they've got a few points of a bounce in a poll and suddenly they feel like, yeah, we're going somewhere.
Or, but yet then they'll say, we don't watch polls, we don't listen to polls.
They all say that.
Only a poll, we don't care about the
poll.
But they all read them and they'll all retweet a poll when it's good for their party. So sometimes they can really change the mood. And there was absolutely no change in the hall, which I found quite telling in its own way, because it was pretty evident that Fianna Fáil being in the high teens or the low 20s, depending on which poll series you look at, they now just seem to be not like accepting in an enthusiastic way, but they've kind of made their peace with that's where they are for the foreseeable. And the other thing I thought, which is very telling, which was that in the course of that day when Fianna Fáil were on stage and ministers were talking about what they were doing, it was very difficult not to be distracted by the YouTube live stream of the Ireland's Future event taking place over on the side of Liffey, which seemed like it was, even if it was only enthusiasts all talking to each other about their chosen cause, that being United Ireland, that it seemed like there was maybe more of a sense of something fascinating worth watching on the other side of the Liffey.
A little bit more exciting when you have, you know, your James Nesbitts and you have, you know, cross-party thing, you have Mary Lou, you have Leo Varadkar, you have Colm Meaney there. Matt Cooper there as well, and the lights went out in them. So I mean, stuff was happening there. Yeah. Even if it was glitchy and mad stuff was happening.
Yeah, and even if you aren't like, obviously, there's a lot of people who are perfectly entitled on the island to pursue a United Ireland as an active goal, and it's something that they want to happen, and they think that it's a solution to a lot of woes, and they're entitled to profess that. It was also just fascinating, almost as a kind of an academic experiment, even if you are detached from the question, just to see how they'd all go about it and the different ways in which the different speakers were proposing that you would try and accommodate unhappy unionists who still want to cling on to a British identity, and how you'd make them feel comfortable in a new Ireland, which is not in any way linked to the island across the water. That it was fascinating just to hear all that being openly spoken about.
Yeah. I know the next event is on in Belfast in the Ulster Hall, which is traditionally linked to unionism. And I know there's potential plans for protests there from loyalist groups. But I see Arlene Foster has also pushed together sort of a counterbalance to the Ireland's Future group, and it's about building up the relationship between Northern Ireland and the UK called Together UK. So we're going to have dueling think tanks and events over the next while.
Well, I see that Sinn Féin are also organising their own sort of public gatherings as well, and they've been looking for a citizens' assembly for a long time. So what they could do is book the same hall at the same time as Arlene Foster, and lo and behold, you actually might have both communities represented in the same room, and maybe they might be able to talk about each other to each other and not around each other.
Very quickly, Gavin, before we wrap up on politics, they had social media classes at Fianna Fáil's Ardéis. Mm. Did you see anybody... anybody noteworthy trying to get tips on how to do it?
Was this the, like, how to be more human on camera?
How to be more human on camera, how to take a good portrait. I did not see many high-profile pursuants of that, I have to be
honest.
There's
a few who need it.
No comments.
Hello there. If you know.
No comments. If you know, you know.
If you know, you know.
Text in your suggestions for who these people might be. Now, one thing which has captured a lot of the world's attention, but perhaps not enough of it, has been the protests in Iran. I know a number of listeners are actually on to us asking us to explain what exactly is happening there. Something rather extraordinary is happening there, is quite simply what is happening. It is quite remarkable, I suppose, to see what we have seen over the last, it's almost a month now since the protests began.
Yeah.
And daily we're getting new footage of women and girls in particular is kind of what the most interesting thing
which is one of the most sensitive things about it. It might be helpful actually for people if we sort of literally go back to square one to try and explain
the genesis
of all of this. So yeah, bring us back for those who are completely uninitiated. There is one name that they keep hearing in connection with this, but they might not understand why she's become this, this figurehead.
You might well have seen it as a hashtag. It's Mahsa Amini. So she was a 22-year-old girl. She died in Iran after she was arrested by the Morality Police, which is an actual institution in Iran. I know we like sometimes in conversations you'll say, oh, it's the morality police, so we'll come after you for this, that, and the other. In Iran, there's a morality police. She was arrested on September the 13th for reportedly not wearing a hijab. 3 days later, she died at the age of 22. Now, the Iranian authorities claimed that she had a stroke, fell into a coma because of a heart condition.
And there was video footage, but people would argue it was heavily edited and there was gaps in that footage.
Yeah, her family as well, very, very stridently coming out saying she was beaten by police.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why she died. And it is since then, you have had dozens and dozens of eyewitnesses of that incident came forward as well. But you have sparked thousands and thousands and thousands of people, both in Iran and around the world as well, who've come forward to protest this in a very evocative way. Mm. You've had young girls in classrooms removing hijabs, turning away pictures of the Supreme Leader, effectively telling him, you know, F your dictatorship.
Mm.
This is different.
To put it into context for people, because they might not realize why this is so sensitive. So the full name of Iran is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And theirs is a country in which the teaching of their religion is not just a matter of what you do if you're an adherent of the religion. It is effectively prescribed as being the law, which is what makes this so sensitive.
It's intertwined into the culture there. Mm. I think what's interesting about this era as well is that we have seen multiple times over the last 10, 20 years, outbreaks of protest about things.
But it's different though.
Like this is something which is sustained all the way through.
Yeah, it has. And actually I was saying to you, even when we were in New York, actually, there was like huge protests outside the UN about all of this as well. Like it's not something that is just happening in Iran. Like it's a global movement. There's definitely a feeling of change here. I think that, you know, to see young women taking a stand in Iran is a really, like, this is a big moment.
Mm. Because they're very much a, marginalized is maybe the wrong word, but they're very much a suppressed community, maybe is the right word, in that country where they're, everything about their dress or appearance effectively is prescribed. Mm-hmm. And for there to be such open disregard for that now does feel like it is a very significant move, because theirs is a country in which, as was evidenced only a month ago, where you can end up paying very, very significant consequences for not going by what the religious book requires you to do.
Yeah, and I think that's something which a lot of the protesters have found as well, is that we have dozens and dozens and dozens of them who have now died. There has been a clampdown of sorts, but there hasn't been an outright crushing of what has become some sort of a rebellion, whatever way you want to phrase this. And that's something which, you know, noted observers of the situation in Iran, like, you know, the BBC, formerly of the BBC, John Simpson, would have said that previously you might have seen the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guard in Iran effectively stamp this out, root people out of their homes, disappear them from their families. But that hasn't happened here to the same degree, or at least what has happened in terms of the clampdown hasn't been enough to stomp this out. Because all of it's interesting that this is again a youth driven movement, because that's what a lot of the protests in Iran traditionally have been. Like, Iran is one of the most educated societies anywhere in the world. Mm. They have incredible second and third level education in terms of the people who go forward, in terms of graduates who go around the world. So this has always been a very, very clued in education system. Mm. But for them not to stop, even though the boot has been put down onto them, is, I think, something worth watching.
Is that maybe we're overreaching here, but is that like a symptom of a world in which you now have such free communications? Like, I remember 10 or 11 years ago, the last time there was something of an uprising in Iran, they tried to turn off Twitter because Twitter was how a lot of these public demonstrations were being organized. And there was a little bit of a worldwide pushback where everyone in the world was encouraged to write in their location as being Tehran, because then it was impossible for the Iranian authorities to filter out who was actually an instigator of this. But we're in a world now where it's very difficult to control anything centrally like that. So if you've got a Telegram or WhatsApp or any other number of messaging apps, that it's much easier to get the word out or to share evidence that other people are rebelling and that you should too.
Yeah, but again, Zara, they have tried. The internet has been cut in many instances in Iran as a result of this, because that's where, when you see these movements take hold, the internet is often the easiest place for these things to sort of capture the imagination.
Yeah, well, it's a place for the conversation, as you say, to take place and for people to have a voice or a platform for it. But, I mean, the thing about it is, like, what happens next? I mean, what changes are coming? Or is there a change coming is the question.
Well, the leader of Iran says no. He has responded this week to the biggest protests in Iran, as we're saying, in years. He has condemned the rioting, he's as he's described it as. He's accused the United States and Israel of planning the protests and of seeding demonstrators into the country, that these are effectively actors rather than, you know, women who are tired of being policed by the Marazi police.
Stop winding up our young people, basically.
Yeah, he described the death of the woman in question effectively as a tragedy, but not something that needs to be carried on by other people. But whether or not that does hold up, because again, I don't think over the course of, you know, the 3 or 4 weeks since it happened, that there's been a drop off. In fact, if anything, it's probably ramped up.
Over the last two days, I think, Zara, I've seen more of it. And I feel like we're hearing more about it. It's become more, like, it's definitely more predominant in the last couple of days. I think it's getting strong.
And we've spoken in other contexts in the last couple of weeks about strength in numbers and how if you feel like there's enough people there that you are willing to do things that you would never have done in isolation. And that is pretty evidently, I think, what's happening here, that you know, it took one person's bravery to do something. And then once there are enough others doing it, they feel like they are emboldened to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll keep an eye on what happens in Iran, because it is quite an extraordinary story. And I'm sure we'll be back.
I can get someone on next week from Iran, actually.
We'll look it out, I think. But turning to matters a little bit closer to home, Liz Truss has given her speech to the Tory party conference, her party's conference in Birmingham. Here's what she walked out on stage to.
We need to get Britain moving. We cannot have any more drift and delay at this vital time.
That is the immortal voice, Heather Small of M People. M People's moving on up.
An unimpressed Heather Small, by all accounts. Yeah.
Heather Small's son is a Labour Party councillor. Diametrically opposed to Liz Truss and her government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The premise there, of course, being that the Conservative slogan right now and the slogan for this event is get people moving. So it's all about moving. So
Get Britain moving.
They went for the most lazy moving song they could think of. And if it's a 90s
But I do love that the lyrics, so somebody tweeted the lyrics to Moving On Up, and it was like, you've done me wrong. Your time is up. You took a sip from the devil's cup. You broke my heart. There's no way back. Move right out of here, baby. Go on, pack your bags.
Pack your bags.
Like, no. The lyrics, even though I get where she was going with the chorus, I feel like, you know,
the first verse.
I was just going to say,
you turn on the tune and within 15 seconds you've been told to get on out of there.
It's a belter tune, you have to play it out for.
Right, Heather Small and them people.
Did you say they never had a number one in
Never had a number one in the UK.
Robbed. Absolutely.
Neither did the Lighthouse family, who we were looking at the same.
The Lighthouse family did not have a number one.
No, that to me is less surprising than them people.
I would disagree, but the go pack your bags motif is something which a lot of Tory MPs are kind of openly angling for Liz Truss, which is astonishing still because she's only a month in the job.
It's just, how is she only a month in the job and this is what's happening? I mean, it's kind of outrageous.
And this is where things get really tetchy, because there is now, bear in mind, by the way, that Liz Truss never had the support of a majority of MPs in the first place. She got into the job because she won over the grassroots, but more MPs wanted Rishi Sunak, her opponent, than her in the leadership election. But they've already changed leader once since the last general election, when the public gave them this massive majority to go into power and govern for 5 years. So it's manageable once, maybe, to change leader and to go on and have a little bit of a pivot. But the question that they now face is, well, if we get rid of her, is it at all tenable that you would change leader twice without at least getting public backing for where you're going? Which means that if the Tories want to stay in power with the majority that they've got, the only person that they can afford to ditch Liz Truss for is the guy that they elected 3 years ago with that giant stonking mandate.
Don't say that.
I don't know.
Don't say that. Think I know it's that bad.
Boris Johnson.
He won. He definitely. I think it's an open secret. He wants the job back, whether that's in the future.
Can we be realistic here now? Is this actually a tangible possibility?
Well, I mean, look at the opinion polls.
Not immediately. Okay,
but if you look at the opinion polls, evidently the last thing that the Tories would want now is an election, because they're basically looking at like a 1997 style. Tony Blair comes in 400 and something seats and they're in opposition for a decade. And they clearly don't want that. So how do you cobble things together? You either have to just make your peace and get behind Liz Truss, or you bring back the last guy, which means that they are now in this situation where, despite openly and like even within her own cabinet, openly trashing the stuff that she's done and undone in the last 10 days, that they're kind of attached to this sinking ship.
There's nothing I enjoy more in politics than when a government is in full meltdown and you are having people openly in the media sledging each other, calling each other spoofers, saying that people, you know, the cabinet colleagues need to shut up and get behind the leader. It's a beautiful thing.
And even like, if the Fianna Fáil are Ardèche, right, there might have been a struggle, but at least they were all on the same page. Like this was the conservative version of the Ardèche. And they're all leaving in what's supposed to be this moment where they leave in like the sense of emboldened unity. And they're all like stabbing each other in the front, not even in the back.
They're moving on up, Gav.
They're moving on up. Pack up your bags. Returning before we go to probably one of our favourite group chat ever items.
Hands down.
Been waiting for this for so long.
To be honest with you, when I look back on the group chats 2022, it's really hard to beat Wagatha Christie in terms of best podcast episode we ever did.
Maybe when we're finished, it'll be a best bits compilation, which will just be a montage.
I'll just run that one, to be honest. I mean, obviously, unless you've been living under a rock.
Rebecca Vardy, who we all remember, lost bad. She's now been ordered to pay.
She took the case, remember, as well, by the way. She took
the claimant in this case, the person who instigated the whole thing because she thought her reputation could be salvaged rather than being as comprehensively trashed as it was by the case.
How could she have thought she would have cleared her name, Richard? Like, how did she think that?
We had the discussion at the start when it was all kicking off about whether or not, maybe publicity would be worth it. Definitely not.
No.
And monetarily, it has now been proven.
It would want to be an awful lot of publicity to cover the bills she's facing now, wouldn't it?
She has been ordered to pay Colleen Rooney's legal costs following the libel trial, and the bill could reach, for Colleen Rooney's side of things, about £1.5 million. She must pay 90% of Rooney's costs, and the first payment of £800,000 must be paid by the 15th of November. And
That's pretty short.
Not at all. That's the 1.5 for Colleen Rooney and the legal and the court side.
And her own,
side. As well. The bill in total there could be about £3 million.
Now, can I ask you a question though? Because you know more about this than me. Like, is that like pocket change to people like the Vardys and the Rooneys?
It's not.
Like, what's their husbands earning?
I don't have it. Maybe Richard could pull it up while we're talking about it. I mean, Jamie Vardy is unfriendly to the guy, but like, he's past his footballing peak. Like, he's in his like mid-30s now, so like, he's only got a few more years of playing and earning at a Premier League level, and then after that it's off foreign, maybe if he wants to continue his career where the money isn't as good as what he's getting right now.
Right.
So like, the average, he's on more than the average Premier League salary.
The average Premier League salary
is £3.5 million
a year.
A year.
And
he's on about 140 a week.
So 140
a
week.
So like, it is a dent in his annual salary.
About £7 million a year. But even before the Tories' U-turn on that tax cut thing, he was still only getting to take home about 3.6 or 3.7.
Okay, yeah. So it's half a year's income for the household then.
Almost a year's post-tax income.
He's not going to be delighted about that, really.
He won't be thrilled, no. He won't be having a party.
It's not like just doing a bit of online shopping and not telling the husband, like, is it really a bit of a bridge for
him? Certainly not that. But like, we're not the only ones, clearly, who are still obsessed with this. Because you have... you've had bidding wars for documentaries and tell all, you know, dramatizations and stuff like that. Really is something. It has lingered that little bit, hasn't it?
Oh, no, it has. And people will totally watch it. The three of us will nearly have to have a viewing party for the Rebecca Bardot.
I will watch all documentaries and drama series simultaneously, multi-box.
Come round to mine, we'll do pizza and wine and we'll watch it. Like, Rebecca, I think I'm more interested in Vardy's one than Colleen's one, though, because I feel like I really want to know what was the thought process behind all of this, Rebecca.
Greg O'Shea meme, what was your thought process?
Kind of.
That?
I want to know what her thought process was. I mean, she's signed a deal to do a tell-all documentary. She wants to claw back the money, obviously, so. So that's her motive. But you think Colleen's doing one as well?
Yeah, apparently so. The Guardian reported that she'd done a deal with Disney Plus. Plus, there's the guys behind A Very English Scandal, that TV drama. Making a dramatization.
I love that.
For somebody who has gotten themselves in such bother, and I'm going to leave it on this point.
Okay.
Rebecca Vardy has spoken out and challenged Colleen Rooney. She's challenged Colleen Rooney to donate the £1.5 million payout to charity.
But no, she has to pay her legal bills. That's not how this works.
See, look, with this podcast started with questions of accountability and it's ending on questions of accountability.
It's questions of accountancy.
Accountancy and accountability.
There is every chance this picks up again.
Can't wait. Bring it.
We'll be right there with it.
Yeah, we can't wait.
That's all we have time for on this episode of the group chat. As much as we love to stay on.
Yeah.
Sarah, Gavin.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much
indeed. And thank you very much to Maxine, to Killian, and to Gareth for helping us through it. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.